Hi everyone, if you listen to the podcast on an Apple device, you can support directly by going on to Apple Podcasts and clicking the subscribe button. And for less than the price of a coffee per month, you can get early access to episodes, episodes in full, and no adverts or sponsorships like this one you're hearing now. It also supports directly to me at the podcast, so thank you very much. Also, don't forget to go and leave the podcast on Apple a 5-star review and make sure you click the follow button too. Thanks.
This is Jim Semivan, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Really interesting, the descriptive language used, like you say, because the immediate thoughts now would be flying saucer, drone, secret tech. None of that was in the lexicon back then. No one on a ship is expecting anything of the sort. Like you say, bioluminescent algae, which I only know that phrase from Moana. You could see under the water, but there's someone describing it coming out the water quite clearly, going up into the sky. And I wonder, in all that research, have you decided that we should treat, or you're going to treat, the USO subject differently to the UFO subject? Is there a marked difference in your research, your approach, or even to the origin of what these objects might be?
Well, a couple of things are different about this particular study that I'm doing. So this collection, and that's really what I'm calling it. It's a collection. So I'm taking each individual case and I'm rewriting it completely. Everything's being rewritten in as excellent a manner as I can to bring life to these cases. So a big portion of the book is simply one case after the next, after the next, after the next, so on. Now I have a lot of analysis that I have within each of those cases, and I have much more analysis I'm still going to write after I finish creating all of these categories, and I'll have a lot more to say. So in terms of any difference, I don't think I'll be handling it radically different than how I've handled UFO cases in the past. I mean, my goal is always to be I want to be as accurate as possible. I want to be as concise as possible, but not leaving out any important information. I do think this phenomenon is absolutely seamless with the rest of the UFO subject. That is, it's all part of the exact same phenomenon. I have no doubt about that. Lots of sightings of classic flying saucers coming into and coming out of the water. And since the latter part of the 20th century, a number of sightings of black triangles entering and exiting the water as well, which really makes me wonder, like, if black triangles are a creation of the black budget world, which some people think, well, they have the ability to go transmedium. So, I mean, it really makes you wonder, like, are we making all those black triangles or not? I tend to think that we're not making all of them. I don't have any reason to think that we've made a transmedium breakthrough in the distant or recent past. I just don't see any evidence for that. So these transmedium objects, I don't think any of them belong to us.
As you say, it's either a case that for the black triangles, for example, given they're a more recent phenomenon, as such, they are either ours, and we have made them with hybrids, whatever that might be, and it's our tech, or it's something else that arrived here much later than whatever else was already here beforehand.
Right. Exactly.
And I wonder, to speculate as well, how much do you think these objects being underwater is to do with it's a quick hiding place, it's a quick place to explore? Or I'm sure you've seen James Cameron's The Abyss. Going back to the late 80s.
That's a great movie. Yeah.
And obviously, spoiler alert, folks, skip 30 seconds if you don't want to hear the ending. But essentially, you've got a whole other civilization living under our oceans. Is it too much of a stretch to think that could be a reality?
Yeah. The Abyss, I think, is one of the greatest, certainly one of the greatest alien movies ever made. And it's one of the best just kind of mystery movies. It's a fantastic movie. But what are they doing? Well, I listened. I think this was on your podcast where I heard Kevin Knuth talking about this. I think it was it with you. If not, forgive me. But I think he made some really astute comments about the you know, reasons why a non-human intelligence would want to make their base in the oceans. It's probably a lot safer. If you've got the ability to make a place for yourself below the oceans, I think this is what he pointed out, have much more stable temperature fluctuations, for one. It's kind of nice. Much more stable, much greater ability to avoid atmospheric storms and other, you know, volatility. If you've got a location deep down in the ocean, it protects you from perhaps maybe dangerous solar radiation if you're sensitive to that, and probably other kinds of airborne bacteria and viruses and whatnot. Like all of those would be probably dangerous for an alien species that's not from here. They can't just probably walk around safely on the surface of the planet. So you would, you know, there would be a lot of good reasons to have a base under the ocean floor or inside an ocean mountain or something like that, that's quite secure. Again, assuming you've got the technology to be able to do that. But if they do, it would be actually great. And then here's the other reason. I've developed my own theory, I suppose, as to why these other beings are here now in large numbers. Like, I do think that we can make a pretty good case that there's been long-term observation by some group of us for a long period of time. I think some of the ancient early UFO stories do strike me as legit. A lot don't. I've become very, very difficult on some of these early cases. I think it's been way overstated. But that doesn't mean I think all of it is invalid. So I think a lot of it is valid. So I can imagine that we've been subject to study for a long time, but think of it from an alien point of view. For nearly all of our time here on this planet, we really were not able to offer them much in the way of certainly what we knew about the world, our ability to manipulate the world. All of that was much more limited than it is until we discovered serious science, you know, really in the last 200 years is when we've really started to remake this world in a powerful way. And I believe that all of this was probably predictable by them. That is our trajectory. I think they were waiting for us to discover science. And I'm sure they knew this was inevitable. Maybe they helped us along the way. Totally possible. But we got there. And that's what's bringing them here in larger numbers. Because I think if there are any of the comparable types of numbers of visitation that we have today that would have happened 300 years ago, I think those people would have known and commented on it. You know, folks 300 years ago were very smart. They were looking at the sky a lot more than we do, probably. And I think they would have seen it, but they didn't. There was no comment on this, or very little, very limited, compared with what we have today. So I think the reality is that this phenomenon has become significant in the last couple of centuries, and particularly from World War II. I think that's when it really ramped up to a major degree. And so if you're them, you're coming here, you're seeing this human species now becoming quite sophisticated, electronic means of detecting you that did not exist recently before, weapons that are actually getting quite serious. Hey, look, we've split the atom, created nuclear weapons, and we have a lot of other very pesky types of missiles and other weapons. Who's to say that they're not vulnerable to some of those? They could very well be vulnerable. And so they have to think, all right, we got to be careful about this. So we need to be here. This is important. These humans are about to leap into our world. We need to be on top of this. We need to monitor this. They're very aggressive. They're very territorial. Just like us, probably. I'm guessing these other aliens are every bit as used to getting their own way as we are. But that's a whole other thing. But they will be wanting to monitor us. And where would they do it from? Well, a base from within the oceans could be quite secure. and still a good place for them to go. Guaranteed that the United States Navy and the Royal Navy and the Russian Navy and now the Chinese Navy and probably a few others are wise to what is going on in some places of this planet as far as undersea activity. But they can't do anything about it. This is beyond their ability to deal with, I think. So I think that's where they would be. I think the oceans and occasionally lakes and other bodies of fresh water as well make a lot of sense for them for a lot of reasons.
And I think if these entities aren't hampered by time or aging, how we are, for example, if they're robots or AI or their lifespan's far greater, you know, if you ask me to watch your car for 5 minutes, Richard, well, you nip into the shop, that's fine. But if you ask me to watch it for a day, then I'm probably not going to do that. You know, that's a long time. Maybe as a favor, you know. But for them, if that 5 minutes might as well be a day, then they experience right. time in a totally different way to them. They could wait it out under the oceans for centuries.
I've wondered about this. Like, this idea of us being a long-term monitoring project, there are things about it that I think, yeah, it makes sense. And there's other things that, like what you're raising here, are difficult for me to grasp. I mean, we in our society have a difficult time planning anything even more than 10 years into the future, let alone 100 or let alone 1,000 or more than 1,000 years. Have we been actually monitored for that long a period of time? But there are, as I think you were kind of hinting at, there's a couple of workarounds. One would be some kind of artificial means monitoring stations that just are kind of automated in some way or another and can send information back. Like, yeah, I could see that, definitely. Some type of avatar situation, perhaps. But even so, like, it still assumes that their civilization, these ETs, we can call them that, may have a remarkable amount of stability to their society that we don't really have at this point. Maybe we will develop that. But for them to be able to have any kind of project that goes for even several centuries, let alone several thousand years, that's kind of mind-blowing to me. But it's not impossible. And I think it, you know, for me, it just, I have to keep coming back down to the evidence. I mean, it's great to theorize. I love to theorize, but you always have to do it based on the information that we actually have. And what it does look like is that there has been a long-term presence, definitely for several centuries and probably for many more centuries than that. And that's the reality. Like, someone has been here for a long time now. And I think they find us and this world very interesting. And they definitely want our water. A number of the cases that I've looked at, I didn't even include all of these cases that I found of objects sucking out pillars of water out of the oceans or bodies of fresh water, frequently the oceans, just sucking up the water. I could go back. I mean, the thing was, in the early stages of my research, I passed by many of those cases. I said, well, they're not technically USOs. And as I kept encountering them, I thought probably should have included more of these, but I've included some. So they're interested in our water, but I think they're definitely interested in us.
Well, in one of your recent presentations, you mentioned some of the hotspots, Puerto Rico, Catalina, and others. I wonder, have you seen any correlating data between what happens in those areas? Is it more random? Is it, you know, geo-specific as to, are they collecting water? Are they monitoring navies, people?
I'll probably be able to answer that a little bit better in a month or two after I start going through, after I start analyzing the data that I'm categorizing. So I'm not done with that. But just observationally, there are a couple of other hotspots. So I'll just mention, yeah, the Caribbean, specifically around Puerto Rico, very, very much so. Catalina Island, the Channel Islands off the coast of LA, also very much so. One that gets overlooked is the northeastern coast of the US and Canada, which when I look at it on my Google Earth, it's actually about as dense as the other places. And then there's other places in the world that probably are as equally big hotspots, but they're just, we don't get as much reporting. So off the coast of the Atlantic coast of South America, I suspect is significant. Definitely in East Asia, like the Sea of Japan, the Sea of Okhotsk, which is north of that. That region of the world, there's actually quite a bit of activity going on. There's quite a bit of activity in the Persian Gulf. And a number of other, not a few other places where there seems to be a lot. The North Central Pacific has got a number of really interesting places. So, but in terms of looking for patterns, I'll probably be able to answer that better. Like, in other words, you're asking, is there a certain type of craft that is seen more than others? And do they happen mostly in the daytime or at night? And those I'll be able to answer much more definitively after I do an analysis of this. It's hard to say right now, but there are definite hotspots. I mean, it's I don't know what else to say. It's fascinating. There's a lot of Navy cases. Most of these are not naval or military, but a lot of them are military Navy cases. Written in usually by some guy who served in the U.S. Navy 20, 30 years earlier and anonymously usually will write into some blog site and tell the story. One thing that people should know, this is relevant for disclosure. This is relevant for anything that the Pentagon has to say about this subject today, is that a number of these USOs have severely interrupted the operations of U.S. naval warships to the point where they have disrupted all communications for upwards of 30 minutes or more, where they have shut down other types of electronics on the ship, weapon systems, for example, non-functional, and even in some cases to the point of shutting the ship down in the water, like stopping the engine somehow, however that is even possible. But some of these ships have been said to be dead in the water with the appearance of these objects. And like for one U.S. aircraft carrier, the USS Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I've got, I think, four cases in the 1950s alone in which that aircraft carrier encountered USOs. You know, I mean, it's quite remarkable. I have one case which is a mind-blowing case relating to another aircraft carrier, the USS John F. Kennedy from 1971. The date is July 2nd, 1971, where, in fact, in this case, an orange glowing sphere, again, just like in the 19th century case I was telling you. Well, the USS John F. Kennedy was in the just north of the Caribbean. It was in the Atlantic Ocean, probably north of Puerto Rico at the time. We don't know exactly where it was, but I think that's probably where it was. And they had just finished a series of qualifying tests, qualcomms they're called. And the witness of this one was responsible for managing or monitoring eight like teletypes in the communication center. So this is 1971. This is state of the art at the time. And these are all different communication systems by which information is coming in and going out of the ship. So in the evening, the ship had just finished a long flight operations period. He's in the communications room when he notices that all the teletypes are printing out nonsensical messages. In fact, all the ship's communications were down. And then he gets on the intercom, and somehow he's hearing someone on the other end yelling, top side of the ship, yelling, "It's God, it's the end of the world." And then he hears some other colleagues saying something, "There's something hovering over the ship." So he goes outside to look, and he sees this huge orange pulsing spherical object. He says it was about the size of a beach ball held at arm's length. That's really large. Totally silent. It's giving off a kind of a warm light about half the strength of sunlight. Now, keep in mind, this is evening, so it would be dark, but it's giving off some decent light, not as strong as the sun. Something like half a minute or a minute, he's looking at it. The ship goes to general quarters. That's battle station, so he's got to go back to his post for the next period of time. And what he said, though, is that during that entire time, it was at least an hour that they were on general quarters, the ship did not receive any messages during this time. The communication system was down for that entire hour. Meanwhile, the radar screens are glowing brightly during this entire event. So clearly this object was there for probably close to an hour. And then he mentioned that they had a couple of F-4 Phantom fighter jets. He said they were unable to start during the incident. And then, you know, what happens after the fact? He said, I didn't see these guys myself. They didn't speak to me, but I talked to a number of my colleagues. They said three or four guys in trench coats were interviewing key witnesses in the aftermath of that. And the only other thing he said was a couple of days later, this is all done, the ship's captain, I have his name, I wrote his name down, I'm trying to remember, Koch, Captain K-O-C-H, I think, said something like, well, you know, certain events that take place aboard a naval ship are classified and should not be discussed with anyone without a need to know. And that was all that was said about that, according to the guy. I think he said, you know, I don't think the guys in the trench coats realized that I had seen this for like half a minute. So he did not get interrogated. But and that's 1971. That's a heck of a story. I read it and I wasn't there. I mean, can I prove? Well, no, I can't prove it. But the problem is it, you know, it fits a pattern. A very, very distinct pattern that a lot of these military guys have offered over the many, many years. And, you know, I mean, if we can ever FOIA these things, if we can get confirmation, great. But meanwhile, I think these stories are too important to ignore. So I'm collecting them to the best of my ability, trying to make them as vivid and accurate as I can so that they can be appreciated.
I can share two stories with you very briefly from a British point of view, from a gentleman who worked on nuclear submarines. We've got Fastlane in Scotland, and he would regularly be on tour or whatever you would call it with these. And I was a kid when he told me this, so they're okay. Very rough memory. The first one, and I asked him about UFOs at the time. I was like, anything weird happen under the water and stuff? Because I had an interest when I was a kid in the subject. And he said, same thing, you know, there's certain things can't really talk about because we're on nuclear submarines. But he told me once they were kind of bumped by something deep in the ocean, wherever they were. And he said sometimes things like whales, etc., would come up pretty close to them, and that it was quite common. And he said when they took a few bumps, and when they pulled up, I'm sure he said Florida, when they, you know, come above the water and they pull into the port, whatever you want to call it, there was a massive claw sticking out the top of the submarine. And he says whoever it was, part of the US Army, came up, took it away over a tarp, drove it away, and that was it. No more heard of it, which was a kind of weird thing. The other one was, that I thought was more interesting. He said they were deep out in somewhere in the ocean, and there was a tapping and the side of the hull, but from the outside, as if something 5,000 feet under the water was actually outside the door. And he said it was some kind of mathematical equation was being tapped into the side of the hull, as if someone was literally outside going, and the guy with the Morse code on the ship was like deciphering it. And they were just like numbers, like a pattern of numbers. And that, again, he said that was the two things he kind of told me, where he was like,
I'd love to put those in my book. Those are great. Those are fascinating.
Yeah. So I always found those interesting as a kid. Always kind of stuck with me. So pretty cool.
Not that many submarine stories. It's hard for me to find submarine stories. I've got more from the Soviet Union than from Western nations in terms of submarines. Most of the Navy cases that I'm finding are from surface ships, not submarines. Although there are some very good ones. Mark, the researcher Mark D'Antonio, American researcher, has a pretty good submarine story that I've got as well, where he was allowed to be on a U.S. submarine. Mark's very, he's still very cagey about some of the details. He doesn't feel that he can give up like where they were and what the ship, what the submarine was. But just saying, he was within earshot. He was on one occasion on a U.S. nuclear sub where they found, they detected what they called a fast mover, which is their phrase for these things. And it was going several hundred knots per hour, which is much faster than any submarine can go. And he talked a little bit about his experience there. He didn't really get a lot more information, but there's not many submarine stories. So those ones that you shared are pretty interesting to me.
Well, I want to get the listener questions just to finish off. But one, I just spoke with your friend and colleague Ryan Eswood on crash retrievals, a real hot button topic, one of the holy grails, yes, probably, of the UFO topic. But I wonder, in your research, have you come across anything like a USO crash retrieval that's happened? You know, if you could talk on that briefly.
Yes, I can. I'm thinking, can I pull this up? I don't know if I'm just going to do this from memory.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, there's actually a couple of cases where it is believed that there were attempts to retrieve an object. In fact, there's been some speculation of something called the Glomar Explorer, which is people can research this. It's a device that is designed to go way, way, way down to the ocean floor, like a claw, and grab. You know, in theory, like if the Soviets or the Russians were to leave something behind, maybe we could go grab it, this type of thing. So it was developed, I think, by Hughes Corporation. And I think that has been involved in retrievals of some of these USOs. There's one case that I included in my book from the late 1960s, around the time of the famous or infamous Shag Harbor incident off the coast of Nova Scotia, Canada, from 1967, which is a very famous, and that is a genuine USO case. But there's one ex-Navy guy who I have his entire story, where he learned that, how am I putting this? That the USS Nautilus, which was, I think it might have been the first nuclear-powered submarine, went through a major refit, an overhaul in the mid-60s. And as a result, after the refit, it was equipped with a kind of large double-door system where it would be able to retrieve mid-sized, medium-sized USOs that were supposedly at the bottom of the sea. So, and that would have been in the late 60s where this could have happened. And I mean, it really makes me wonder, would the Nautilus have been even around, excuse me, in the area of Shag Harbor at that time? And I think it would have been because it operated in the Atlantic Ocean. But anyway, there is a claim that submarine itself was involved in USO retrieval operations. Whether it actually, according to the source of that, it did retrieve a number of them. How many? I'm not really sure, but it's a claim. It's one of these stories that just circulated very, very quietly, and then it made it to me. So I don't know if it's true. I spoke years ago to a man who has since gone public with his name. His name is David Noble Whitehorse. Served in the U.S. Navy in the early 60s. And I interviewed David well over a decade ago, about at least 10, 12 years ago. And he, in 1962, was involved in He was part of something called Operation Dominic, which was a series of high altitude nuclear detonations that the U.S. was doing throughout 1962. And a lot of these detonations took place over the Pacific Ocean. He was aboard a ship called the USS Finch, and they were, I think, about 500 miles off the coast of Hawaii at the time, near Johnston Atoll. That's what this was. My memory is all coming back. So he said they did a launch from that location, and he said, you know, what always used to happen back in those days is that there would be all these bogeys in the atmosphere, UFOs, and just before detonation would occur, they would all hightail it out. They would disappear. He said, but this one did not. This one did not disappear. And he said, I was below deck during the test. We all had to be below deck, all non-essential personnel. But while the test was happening, an officer came down and said, I want you, and you up right now. I want you on deck. And so David goes up there with some other guys, and they're standing on one side of the ship, and their ocean sprays hitting them. It's intense. And they're ordered simply to observe and look straight ahead. It's very bizarre. This is exactly what he said, though. They were there to be a witness. And so what he witnessed was this object zooming by the ship horizontally at a very, very high rate of speed. He was doing a cross train with the radar people. And so he gets the scuttlebutt from the radar guys later that night, I think. And they're all saying, oh my God, we tracked this UFO. When we did the detonation, this object came down from the sky and crashed into the ocean. And as he was there, he said that we had several ships en route to the location where this ship went down, clearly to retrieve it. So we're in October of 1962. This is the same month of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when this whole thing happened. And so that was all he knew about it for years. And then he said, some years later, he's still in the Navy in the early 70s, and he's at Guantanamo Bay, where the U.S. Navy has an installation there. And he's at a bar having a drink, and he talks to this other Navy guy who's having a drink, and they start sharing stories. And one's like, yeah, I've seen some weird stuff. And how it would go is like, oh, yeah, well, let's see how weird your stuff is compared to my stuff. Turns out that they were both involved in the same event. And the other guy that he met was a high-level, top-level Navy diver. And he had been the first guy to go to dive down to do initial visual recon of whatever it was that was down there. Now, that's a weird thing, because I don't know how deep this guy could have gone, where he could have gone. The Pacific Ocean is really, 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 really deep. And a diver can't go down to the ocean floor. That's not possible. So it's not clear to me. But according to what David said, the guy somehow encountered this craft. He was able to get a look at it. He said it was honeycombed, somewhat translucent. He could almost see compartments and hive-like compartments in it. And actually was so nervous, he lost bladder control. So he peed uncontrollably, got very, very upset, very nervous, was taken up shortly after that and never went back. But that was his story. And it turned out they believed that was from the same event.
Wow.
So I don't know that it was from the same event, but it seemed like it was. That was what he said. The only objection I've always had is, where are you going to have... You can only go down so deep if you're a diver.
Yeah.
And I've never been able to square that one.
No, I get that. That makes sense. Listen, let's dive ourselves into some listener questions just to finish off with the short time we've got left. Newman is a member of your website and has said he's tried to ask this on many occasions, but he knows you're busy, so he wanted to try and get it on the podcast. He asks, with several anecdotal reports having mentioned complex interactions happening in proximity or under direct involvement of water, have we possibly neglected too much the role water seems to play, not just as a travel medium, but also possibly as a possible kind of fuel source that facilitates the function of UAP and NHI technology?
That's a fantastic question. Well, thank you, Newman. You're finally able to reach me through Andy's show. So, I have actually not even considered that. I didn't even think about that. So, and which is crazy because we've known, I mean, there have been human inventors trying to figure out ways of using water, actual water, to serve as a kind of fuel. And of course, if you're able to get hydrogen fuel cells, I mean, what is water? It's mostly hydrogen and oxygen. So in theory, it could be possible to do that. I don't know what the science of that is. And I probably will want to look into that because that's actually quite an interesting lead. So thank you, Newman. That was his name, Newman?
Newman, yeah. Newman. Right. Newman always asks some very good questions. And if I had a spare hour, I would give you the context he sent along with the question as well. So they're always meticulously put together.
I don't know if I should be embarrassed or not, but I've not thought of that.
No, it's very interesting. It's an interesting one. Question from Shardul. Shardul asks, UFOs are known to be interested in nuclear technology, and there are currently a total of 9 nuclear states across the world. Do you think these nations, especially those not fully aware of the phenomenon, are faced with a Stanislav Petrov conundrum daily? And I had to check Stanislav Petrov. He was the officer in 1983 who averted the Soviet missile crisis, you know, the false alarm.
Okay. Well, these objects, these intelligences, I don't think there's any question they are very interested in our nuclear technology. Always have been, right from the beginning. I don't know if that's their number one concern, but it might be. And not always in a way that is positive, as he was just indicating, Stanislav Petrov, who, from what we have learned, an object seems to have enabled, not disabled, enabled the launch sequence of a Soviet nuclear missile, and the Russians were able to disable that at the last minute. But it makes me think that there are different factions of ET that are dealing with us, including maybe we can call them rogue factions. I mean, I'm just speculating and I wonder, but I really do think that that's possible. But I'm not really sure how to answer the question. It's like, is asking, are we just kind of waltzing into not realizing the danger of the nuclear weapons in conjunction with ET? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, one of the recent states, I believe India has nuclear weapons, don't they?
Yeah.
And India are much more of an impoverished nation, as folks will know. And you wonder if they're not fully up to speed with, for example, India and Pakistan, very tense relationship. Mm-hmm. If these objects are flying around, you would imagine Russia, the US, China are more aware that there may be something in the air that isn't them, that their systems may be picking these things up. But are the Indians and the Pakistanis potentially hovering over the button, ready to go?
I think they are aware, actually. I think there's very good reason to think that the government of India is aware of this problem. There isn't a lot, but there is some Indian ufology that's out there. There are UFO stories that do come out of India pretty regularly, and many of them occur near the Himalayas. I'm just thinking of the Indian cases that I know of, many of them up in the north. Now, Pakistan's over to the northwest part. Most of the cases I'm thinking of are in the north central, but still, I don't think there's any question that the Pakistanis, we're talking, yes, India per capita is poorer than most Western nations, but India's government is very sophisticated. Their military is highly, highly sophisticated. I have no doubt that they are well on top of this. Plus, they have hostilities, border hostilities, I should say, with China over areas like Tibet. So I think they are quite aware.
Do you think in the background, Richard, when one of these nations, an up-and-coming nation, develops nuclear capabilities, the US, the Russians, the Chinese maybe do have some kind of back-channel communication to say, look, there may be something you want to know about here in terms of issues we have had. Do you think that would even need to happen?
I would like to think that there is. There used to be. We know that there was. I mean, we know even Kennedy and Khrushchev back in the early 60s seemed to have some kind of communication going and possibly relating to the UFO subject. I mean, 11 days before Kennedy was assassinated on November 11th, 1963, he did sign a letter where he was apparently ordering the CIA to engage in transfer of information with the Soviets relating to UFOs to avoid confusion and to avoid an accidental war happening due to mistaking a UFO for some kind of nuclear or for a missile. This was explicitly something he was talking about. And then during the 1970s, we do know there were some agreements between the United States and the Soviet Union, again, to reinforce this type of dialogue relating to this. But where that has gone since the end of the Cold War, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, it's a really good question because it's not clear to me that the United States is really doing a lot with communicating some of these things with other, with the Russians. I think communication with the Russians has reached an all-time low in our current era. You know, you talk about the Crocus City massacre, just which happened, you know, in Moscow just last week. There's all of this controversy. What did the U.S. intelligence know about this? And why did the U.S. not tell the Russians more of what they apparently knew? They didn't tell them enough. So there's a limited, very limited sharing of information. And does it go to the UFO sphere? Is a really good question. I don't know who knows the answer to that.
Richard, there's a lot of questions I'm going to have to get to another time with you just because we are running short now. But I wanted to ask you this one from Jag. He asks, had Richard heard anything about the potential signal discovery by SETI in the EU? And if so, does he have any thoughts? This came up recently on social media where Simon Holland had mentioned another professor who said she has heard SETI have detected signals and are getting more funding to go and chase this up, essentially.
I don't know much about that, so I'm going to have to look into that. That's very interesting.
I don't know the full details myself, but Simon Holland calls himself professor. He's not actually a professor, which in itself is an issue. But yeah, Dr. Andrew McGrillin here, you know, if I'm not a doctor. So yeah, okay. But that's one I need to look into myself. But listen, let's finish off very quickly. This year, you are one of the headline speakers, as we say, at Contact in the Desert. That's May 30th till June 3rd at the Renaissance Esmeralda Resort and Spa, Indian Wells, California. The event can be in person or live streamed. Tell us about the event, Richard, and what you'll be doing there.
I haven't finalized my lectures, so I've been very, very naughty, and I need to get that done. And in fact, I was just talking with my wife about this today, and I need to give them my my titles and descriptions. So probably one will have something to do with my current USO research project. I did speak about that last year, but I'll have more and different things to say this year. I will very likely have something to say about the current status of the UAP disclosure scenario. And I'll be doing a third. I'm doing two lectures and a workshop, I believe. So I'll have a third topic that I need to decide what that will be.
I think you're on a few panels as well, by the looks of it. You're on disclosure panel. You're on the Legends panel. So you've got your work cut out for you over a few days, it looks like.
That'll be fine. Look, I mean, for me, I'm in an interesting position. I work on this subject literally full time every day. So my head is always in it, and so I'll be ready. Whatever we end up doing, I'll be ready to do. That'll be just fine. But I do need to get my lectures together on that. So I'm doing this book. I've actually got another book project I'm working on. We can talk about that another time. And I'm reading the audiobook version of Volume 2 of UFOs and National Security State. Finally. I'm trying to, because I've never been able to have an audiobook of that. No, I've tried to get other readers. The book's too long. So I decided I'm just doing this one myself. So I'm doing that in the evenings. But I've got to get these lectures ready. So I'm looking forward to it, though. I mean, that's become a really nice conference, Contact in the Desert, near Palm Springs, California, if someone can get out there. One thing that Tracy and I always really try hard to do is to be available for attendees who are there and to just be there at our table to talk to people who want to come up and talk to us. So we try very hard to be visible there and meet as many people as possible. That's always been important to me. people pay good money to go to these things, and they have every right to meet the speakers and the presenters who are there.
Awesome. Well, folks, if I've not got to your question, I'll prioritize you next time. I'll get Richard back on hopefully sooner than 10 months.
We'll do it sooner.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. Get those tickets at contactinthedesert.com. Richard, very roughly, timescale on the USO book being finished?
A couple of months. Won't be that long. I was hoping for May, and I don't think May will happen. But I do think summer for sure. Summer for sure. July, I think, can absolutely happen.
And is that going to come out this year? Do you think the book actually will be out summer?
Oh, yeah. That's what I mean. I think the book, both volumes, I think I'll have to publish it in two volumes, will be out. I'm gonna put myself on the line and say we'll have it on July of this year. I think that's a pretty good possibility. It's a good bet. The cases are done. The writing is pretty smooth. I need to get the rest of it illustrated, and I've got to get my appendices in there. But it's all coming together very well. So I think this summer, the book, both volumes of it will be published and they'll be available.
Well, we at least know it's going to be out before Luis Elizondo's book at this rate. So I look forward to that, and also Luis's book when it comes out.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Do you know when his is coming out? I have no idea.
It's not November. I can tell you that much that people were saying online. There isn't a date for it yet.
Oh, so it's farther out.
Rumors going about it's going to be November. There's some publication dates on websites that are just, you know, random dates. It's not correct. Lou himself has said multiple occasions there isn't a date for it. Well, so yeah.
All right. So purely selfishly, I'm glad mine will get out there first, because he'll get all the attention once his comes out. So I'll get my book will have its little moment in the sun, and that'll be just fine.
Well, people seem hungry for a book, so good time for it. Thank you for your time, Richard, and speak to you again soon.
It was a total pleasure, Andy. Thank you for having me here.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify. Just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like